Thank you, Rabbi Engel. It's great to be back in Chicago. And it's really an honor to be here with special friends. When we study Torah together, our goal is really multifold. If we're studying a course in halakha, then our interest is to find out what we should do. If we're studying Gemara B'Iyun, trying to dig underneath and get the concept of the law, understand how it applies in various cases and what the limitations are. We're studying a chapter of Tehillim, exploring more the avenues and the chambers of the human heart and the Jewish heart, and how we reach out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in times of need, in times of thanksgiving. And there are so many different vestibules in the palace of Torah. When we study Torah, we are turning on lights in our own mind, and lights in that larger vestibule of Torah. And much is the same as when we're studying Sefer Bereishit. But there is one common piece to our study of Torah. The goal of the study of the Torah is for us to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the most powerful way possible. We see in the parsha we read yesterday, HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates us, B'Tselem Elohim. And almost anybody who has attempted to interpret that very difficult phrase has come up with a slightly different explanation of what it means to be in the image of God. Does it mean free will? Does it mean control? Does it mean creativity? But it all seems to come down to that faculty that really distinguishes us from the animal world, is our ability to think, and more critically, to have that thinking impact on our lives. When we study Torah, whatever area of Torah we're studying, the ultimate goal is that it should impact on our lives. If we walk away from a shiur and say, aha, that was fun, and it's all we say, it was entertaining. And there's a value to that. But if you walk away from a shiur, or from a time with a chavruta, or a time studying alone, and say, aha, now I get this. Now I'm going to do this a little differently. Now I'll think a little differently about what I do. Then we've really accomplished the goal. The ultimate goal of Talmud Torah is transformative. So when Jewish people get together, and Baruch Hashem, and a real honored tzibur, beautiful tzibur, and together explore Torah in a way that is transformative, it has the power and the ability to transform many things. The residual good effects of Talmud Torah are untold, but are visible. They happen in all sorts of ways. And it's certainly our tefillah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that our studying Torah together will be transformative here in the community, in a way that will be all smiles and all happiness. I'd like to preface the specific content of the shiur with a larger question that is a very famous question that Rashi raised yesterday. Part of the beauty of Talmud Torah is that Rashi lived from 1040 to 1125, and yet Rashi still asked the question yesterday. What was Rashi's very famous question about Bereishit? Here you open up Bereishit, it's exciting, we've got about 3 months to read Bereishit, and Rashi says, let's X out the whole thing. Where should the Torah have started? What does Rashi say? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Elohim. What's the assumption behind Rashi's question? That the Torah is a book of mitzvot. It's there to teach us what to do, what to avoid. What are the consequences of our actions? And therefore, all of Sefer Bereishit, and indeed, most bizarrely, the entire narrative of Yetziat Mitzrayim is superfluous. It's irrelevant, really. And Rashi's question is a great question. His answer is very unsatisfying. And all the Rishonim say, nice question, we don't like the answer. His answer famously is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed to introduce his role as creator of the world in order to defend us against the claims that we have stolen Eretz Yisrael. By the way, I don't know if you noticed the news lately, it doesn't work. The Ramban's reaction to that is, that's a nice answer, and all that explains is one pasuk. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim et haaretz, and then, HaKadosh Baruch Hu azal lachem, that'll be fine. God created the world, he's in charge, whatever land we got, he gave to us, we didn't steal it. Now let's go to the mitzvot. And that's why all of the other Rishonim pick up on the question and then run with it and give different answers. And famously, the Ramban says, do not think that Bereshit, that the focus of Bereshit is about the creation of the world. Bereshit is about the creation of a nation. There is no way to understand the significance of mitzvot and of the divine directives that surpass mitzvot and encompass mitzvot, the larger statements, without knowing Sefer Bereshit. The first words that we hear directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Anochi Adonai Elohecha asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Yisrael, and we scratch our heads and said, what were we doing in Egypt to start with? Well, there were some brothers. They didn't get along. And they sold one of their brothers into slavery. Why didn't they get along? Well, because Yaakov, our father, ended up marrying two sisters. Not a great idea. And so the children of one sister weren't really happy with the child of the other sister who was favored. Well, how did that happen? Well, Yaakov was stuck. He was in the clutches of the evil Lavan. How'd he end up there? And that brings us to today's shir. So everything that we study in Torah subsequently is anchored in Sefer Bereshit. I'd like to posit that if you look through all of the major stories throughout Tanakh, every one of them is anchored in Sefer Bereshit. Bereshit is the foundational stone of our history. Mordechai and Esther is a form of a replay of Yosef in Paro's court. And Chazal make all of those connections. Ruth and Boaz explicitly connect themselves to Yehuda and Tamar in Bereshit. So Sefer Bereshit has this overwhelming significance. And sitting at the heart of Sefer Bereshit is a conflict that seemingly begins in about 5 weeks in Parsha Toldot, but I believe may begin a little earlier than that. And it is a conflict that begins then, and when does that conflict end? The answer is, well, what time is it now? Not yet. What we're going to do today is take a look at the seeds of that conflict. And that conflict as it plays out in Sefer Bereshit itself, and limit our discussion to Sefer Bereshit. That's the vestibule we'll try to enlighten a little bit this morning. Mirat Hashem, next week we're going to look and see how that conflict plays out after the principles are no longer here. And that is after Sefer Bereshit in the rest of Tanakh. And the conflict has an interesting history in Tanakh. And the third shiur is going to be devoted really to bringing that conflict into modern terms through the eyes of the Midrash. And the conflict between Yaakov and Esav in the Midrash is a fascinating tour that sadly, as we study it, and again our study is of a practical nature, taking a look at how this impacts on our lives, it'll be a little too easy to point to headlines. We'll try to avoid doing that. We'll see where that goes. But today we're going to limit ourselves to Sefer Bereshit. If you take a look at the handout, I'd like you to look at the one source that's large. It's source number 4. I believe in English it's not any larger than the rest, but it's also source number 4. The background. Yitzchak, you're all familiar, has married the lovely Rivka. I got a secret for you. She wasn't free. Don't spread it. Just a parenthetic note, it's critical. I think we all grew up with 3, didn't we? I mean, raise your hands if you all grew up with 3. 3, okay, good. Right, where does 3 come from? This is a total parenthesis, but it's just too much fun to ignore.
He was 37 at the Akedah.
Because Yitzchak was 37 at the Akedah. How do we know that? Was Yitzchak carted at the Akedah? How do we know he's 37?
Because his mother died at 127.
Oh, his mother died at 127, right? Sort of middle age. And how old was she when Yitzchak was born? Let's do the math. She was 90, which means how old was Yitzchak when she died? 37. So far the math is good. I have one question. Who said the Akedah took place when Sarah died? Aha. What?
She heard the news of the Akedah.
Very interesting. Okay, so the entire piece comes from a Midrash known as Seder Olam. Midrash Seder Olam is a 2nd century Midrash attributed to Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta. The goal of Midrash Seder Olam is to put all of the events from creation all the way until his day into a chronological framework. We don't call it a timeline. And so many of the Midrashic associations that we have, different characters meeting in Midrash that didn't meet in Tanakh explicitly, of ages of people, of how old someone was when something happened, are all from Seder Olam. Seder Olam, like many texts from the era, has various versions. And fortunately, Professor Chaim Elkowski of Bar-Ilan, about 3 years ago, published a work that we were waiting for about 20 years. He had been promising for 20 years, a critical edition of Seder Olam, based on all the manuscripts. So the first thing I did when I got it was to check the versions on that particular passage about the age of Yitzchak at the Akedah, and therefore the age of Rivka, etc., and almost all of the best manuscripts have Yitzchak as being 26 at the Akedah, which means that there's another 11 years post-Akedah that we hope Avram didn't say anything to Sarah, which, by the way, means something else. If Rivka really is born at the moment of the Akedah, which is another assumption, then if Yitzchak is 37 at the time of the Akedah, and Rivka is born at that moment, what do we know explicitly about how old they were when they got married?
He was 40.
He was 40. That's in the text. So if he's 40 and he's 37 years old or older than she, then what do we have? She's 3. The interesting thing is that the cleaner texts of the Seder Olam have Yitzchak as 26 at the Akedah, and then when he marries Rivka, she is 14. Now, to us, 14 sounds... how do we say it? Ew. I mean, it's a lot better than 3, but it's still... Oh. So we have to remember something. This is something critical when studying Bereishit. It's even critical when studying Gemara. And it's even critical when studying medieval Tshuvot. The world of the Tanakh, the society of the Tanakh, the society of the world of Chazal in the times of the Gemara is not our society. And it is a big mistake when we're trying to turn on the lights in Sefer Bereishit to use the wrong bulb. Doesn't fit. And to use a bulb from a 21st century Western society to try to make sense of the ancient world doesn't help us at all. We're in the wrong room where the bulb's not working. In the ancient world, how old were men when they got married? Typically. Right. So in the pre-Avram world, they are, you know, they've got a triple free membership in AARP before they start looking at gold. I understand. But in the world later of Tanakh, how old are men when they get married? The answer is, we don't know. There's a wide range of ages, and we really don't have a sense. And the bottom line criterion is, did the man build up his estate enough to be able to afford to get married? That's the question. How old were girls when they got married? And I say girls deliberately. Right around 12. Unless they were from some criminal family or, you know, in some other way, just not marriageable. They were around 12. Because in the ancient world, you were a daughter, then you were a wife, then you were a mother, then you were a grandmother, and somewhere in the middle of that, you died at, you know, some very, unfortunately, you know, often childbirth, etc. But it was a very different life. There was no NCSY. There was no Bnei Akiva. There was no summer camp. There was no high school. A lot of people think, yeah. You went straight from kidhood to adulthood. And you didn't waste childbearing years. Now, we can say whatever you want about that and say, thank God we live now. And I say, thank God we live now. That's fine. But we can't read Bereishit accurately without keeping that in mind. It's a very different world. That will actually come to play in our course study today. So now, the background. Rivka, 14. Take that version of the Seder Olam. Marries Yitzchak. And they're married for quite a while and no kids. Seems to be a problem in the family. And they pray, and Yitzchak prays in the presence of Rivka, Unochach Ishto, and God answers, and she's pregnant. And she's pregnant, and she doesn't know it, seemingly, but she got twins. And the twins are tussling. Now this is Nebuch, a young girl, far away from home, in a foreign land, all alone. She's got some nursemaids with her, okay. And she's going through this weird experience. And the way that we've shown him describe it, she goes up to other women and says, is this what you experienced with pregnancy? No. So she's not sure what's going on. And she goes to find out what's going on. Does that mean that she herself prayed to God? Or does it mean she went to seek from a prophet, like most Rishonim read? One way or another, she asks God to tell her what's going on. What does God say? Vayomer Adonai la. Shnei goyim bevitnech, ushnei leumim mimeayich yiparedu, ulaom milaom yamatz verav yavod sair. Now let's take a look at these four phrases because our entire relationship of Yaakov and Esav is defined by this one pasuk. This is the nevuah that sets the course of Jewish history forever, right here. Shnei goyim bevitnech. What's the first piece of news that Rivka gets in this prophecy? Well, it's the first piece of news. Somebody just said it. Twins. In other words, it's not one kid, it's two kids. But there's more news in Shnei Goyim Bivitnech. They're not just two kids. What are they? Two nations. I don't know about you, but if I stop at that point, Shnei Goyim Bivitnech, say, Shkoyach, thanks a lot. That's beautiful. I'm going to have two kids and they'll both be powerful leaders of nations. I'm very happy at that point. Maybe. Ushnei le'umim. What's the difference between a goy and a la'om? A goy seems to be more of a political identity, and a la'om seems to be more of an ethnic identity. But on the other hand, many, the Malvim wouldn't be happy with this, but many would say the terms are synonymous, and for poetic reasons, we vary them. Not to repeat the same words. Fine, two nations. Mime'ayich yiparedu. What does that mean, mime'ayich yiparedu? They will separate from your womb. Doesn't mean separate from your womb, but they are going to go their separate ways from the womb. What does that mean? What new information is she getting in that prophecy? That these two nations, first of all, are separate. They're not going to work together, and that separation will be seen when? Immediately at birth. Not some point down the line. They're not going to hang out together for 20, 30, 40, 50 years and then down the line go their separate ways. It's going to happen immediately. Now, two nations can go separate ways and never have anything to do with each other. Point three. Lo'om mila'om ye'ematz. What will each nation do with the other? They're going to struggle with each other. They're going to be in relation, and it's not going to be a good one. It's going to be a struggling, a conflicted relationship. There may be conflicts that happen occasionally or happen fairly frequently in which there is never a winner. A lot of people in the world would like to say that's what the late 40s through the mid 80s was between the Soviet Union and, remember Soviet Union? The future former Soviet Union and the United States. No winner. Thank God there were no losers. How does the nevuah end? It doesn't end like that. Virav Ya'avod Sa'ir. I don't know how they translate. What does the translation say? Okay. Problem with the translation, and translations are deaf to learning. They're vital. They're absolute life for learning. Because you need to understand what's being said. And then when you get deeper into learning, they cut you off. Because the beauty of the text in the original is the use of language, and in some cases, deliberate ambiguity. Which when you translate, you lose. Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir means what? The elder shall, Ya'avod Sa'ir, will serve the younger. Or, Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir, the elder will enslave the younger. Who's going to be on top? I don't know. And the ambiguity seems to be deliberately put in, as Chazal pick up, that the later Yaakov and Esav representatives in the world, one will always be on top. Which one? Depends on the week. Depends on the century. Depends on the period. Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir can go either way and will go either way. Will go both ways alternately. Now put this nevuah together and you've got what starts out very promising as at the end very scary. Let's see how it actually plays out. And I want to do two things with the time that we have. I want to look forward to the end of Bereshit, or really the end of where Yaakov and Esav interact in Bereshit, and see how this all plays out. But then the critical thing is I want to look backwards. Because we should stop and ask the following question. Who are we talking about here? We're talking about Yitzchak. This is Yitzchak as the father. Who is Yitzchak? Yitzchak is the one proper, legitimate, full, whatever you want to call it, son of Avram and Sarah. And what's his job, therefore? What's Yitzchak's job in the world? What's he supposed to do? He's supposed to continue the mission of Avraham. To teach the entire world. To makariv the entire world. To be a wonderful model of what it means to be devoted to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And nobody's more devoted, if you think about it, than Yitzchak. And without Yitzchak having anything to do with it, seemingly, we're told that in the one pregnancy that they have, conflict is being born. And that's a prophecy. Conflict, which is going to involve subjugation, on and on and on. So we really do have to ask the question, why? Why is this the prophecy given? Why isn't the prophecy given? Goy bevitnech. Vivarech et kol mishpachot ha'adama. Beautiful. Or, if you want, Shnei goyim bevitnech. Excuse the editorial license. Ushnei li'umim bimeayich yivarechu. Ula'om bila'om yitchazek. They will strengthen each other. And then, v'nivrachu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama, which is a nice ending. Why not? Why not? Because this is what had to be. And then we have to ask the question, why? Why is this what had to be? Let's begin by looking forward, and then we'll look back. In Source 5, we read about what happens after this prophecy. And we see that at least the most obvious expression of the prophecy comes true immediately. Shnei lumim mimeayich yiparedu. What happens? They come out and they look different. Esav is admoni. What does admoni mean, by the way? Yeah, red skin, ruddy. Ruddy. Parenthetically, just a lot of fun. We always, when teaching Sefer Shmuel, I always ask the kids at some point around Perek Tzayin or Meet David, what did David look like? Red hair. I said, how do you know he had red hair? He's Admoni. I said, good. Who's the other Admoni in Tanakh? I said, Esav. Why is he an Admoni? What does Admoni mean? It means ruddy. And both David and Esav, weird to link them together, but there's a lot of links between them. Interesting. Think of David and Esav as both being Admoni, ruddy. Why is David Admoni? What does David do for a living as a kid? He's a shepherd. What does he wear? Really skimpy clothes. That's why he's not used to the big armor when Shaul puts it on him. And he's always running around outside with that slingshot, protecting the flock and practicing on giants. So he's exposed to the sun, so he's ruddy. Good, we're going to see about Esav here, and what kind of person he is, and why he would be ruddy. But he's born ruddy. And hairy. And Yaakov is born differently. And what happens when they grow up? Sorry, before that, when they're born, there's a dramatic scene that we see at the birth. A scene that plays out in reverse when Tamar has her twins. But in this scene, Esav is born first, and he's the big one, and he's the hairy one. And where's that? Where's Yaakov? So what immediate picture do you get if you know the Nevuah? If you don't know the Nevuah, it's just weird. If you do know the Nevuah, what is it? These two are separate beings that are linked. And the link is not friendly. They're not holding hands as they come out. This little baby is holding on to the heel of the other one. Why? Give me a ride? What's he doing?
Trying to bring him back.
Exactly. So the conflict is right there at birth. Mime'ayachi paredu. The kids grow up, and what does Esav do for a living? It's critical to see carefully what it is that Esav does for a living and what Yaakov does for a living. Because we are so guided by certain images we have, and maybe even picture books, from our youth, that we don't necessarily read the Pasuk clearly. Take a look at Pasuk Chavzayin. Vayigdalu ha'ne'arim vayehi Esav ish yodei tzayid. So what does Esav do when he grows up? Ish yodei tzayid. He's a hunter. Ish sadeh. That's separate. What's that?
Outdoorsman.
Outdoorsman. Man of the field. But we know the word sadeh from other places. For instance, Yitzchak himself is famously associated with the sadeh. In the very famous scene when Rivka comes, Vayitzei Yitzchak, Masuach Basadeh. And what did Yitzchak do for a living? Remember from his visit to the Plishtim, Plashet? Yitzchak is a farmer. He's a man of the ground. Man of the land. By Yisrael Yitzchak, he plants. He's the only one of the Avot who engages in farming that we hear of. And Esav is evidently a man of the... A farmer, oh, thank you. A farmer besides being a hunter. What does Yaakov do? Yaakov Ishtam... Yoshev Ohalim. What does Yoshev Ohalim mean?
Base Medrash.
Okay. And we're familiar with that. And there was a piece of that that happens with Yaakov. Simple pshat in Yoshev Ohalim, like the Radak says and many other Rishonim, is Yoshev Ohalim comes from yesterday's parsha. There's a fellow named Lamech. Lamech has three kids, three sons and a daughter. Yuval and Yaval and Tuval Kayin. Like, he liked the sound of Baal. One of them is Avi Kol Tofes Kinor V'Yugav, the first musician. One is Avi Lotesh Choresh Nechoshet of Arzel, the first smith. And what's the other one? Avi Yoshev Ohel Umikne. The first one to dwell in tents and shepherd. So the Radak says, you know what Yoshev Ohalim is? He's a shepherd. Think about it. Esav's a farmer and Yaakov's a shepherd. Where does that put them on the conflict zone? You guys remember Rodgers and Hammerstein's famous Oklahoma? Okay, you're all nodding. Remember the song, the second to last song? The last song is the OKL, where they spell it out for people who don't know how to spell Oklahoma. Right? What's the one before that? Oh, the farmer and the rancher should be friends. Should be friends, but why? So why isn't it Pashut that the farmer and rancher? By the way, whenever you quote secular things, you have to sound extra yeshivish. So, why is it not Pashut that the farmer and the rancher are going to be chaverim? Because they hate each other. Why do they hate each other? Because the rancher herds his flock and they eat up all the crops. As a small aside, in what society that we read about in Sefer Bereishit were shepherds hated? Egypt. When Yosef's brothers come down, what does Yosef tell his brothers to tell Paro that they do for a living? We're shepherds. Why? So that Paro will put them far away because the Egyptians hate shepherds. Why do the Egyptians hate shepherds? Because the Egypt is an entirely farming community. Think about Paro's dreams. Cows who plow and stalks of wheat. Parenthetically, in May, I believe it was, there was some journal, I don't remember the name of the journal, that published some DNA evidence from mummies. Chweisnisht. That there's a lot of evidence that in ancient Egypt they had a vegetarian diet. And animals were only used for working in the field. Could be. But we know that shepherds and farmers, so right away they're set on a collision course. Okay. Mimeyachi paredu. And then what happens? It plays out exactly as you figure. A yeshev ohalim, a more of a homebody, even though he's a herder. He's defined by sitting in tents. He's preparing food. This is evidently way far away because otherwise, why isn't Esav getting food from one of the slaves at the house or from Rivka? Why is he getting it from Yaakov? But Yaakov is preparing food. Esav comes home from the hunt and he's hungry. And immediately what happens? I'll give you food if. Which is what prophecy? La'omi, la'omi amatz. There's going to be a struggle. You want food? Fine. Sell me the bechora. And what does the bechora immediately do? Rav, ya'avod, sa'ir. It redefines it. The younger one's now in charge. So in this little scene, which if you think about it, is an unnecessary scene for us to read. Because everything that we get from the conflict, we get from the later bigger scene about the bracha. But we have this scene because it tells us right away this prophecy comes to fruition and to realization. Esav right away and Yaakov right away are different, are separate, they look different, they behave differently, they're involved in different livelihoods. And their point of contact is conflict. And the result of the conflict is power. And the power is, again, a flip where the younger one has power over the older one. Remember I mentioned that all of the stories that we read in Tanakh can be ultimately found somewhere in Bereishit? I'm going to take that one step further. I believe that all the stories you find in Bereishit, and by extension later in Tanakh, ultimately have their anchor in the first 11 chapters of Tanakh. First 11 chapters of Bereishit. Bereishit and Noach. Because Bereishit and Noach are before the national story starts. The national story starts with the words Lech Lecha. Where do we have a conflict between a farmer and a shepherd? And who's the one who's favored? The younger one is favored. And by the way, how does the older one behave? Violently. Do you see Yaakov and Esav? It of course plays out much differently. But you already see the roots of that. Okay. Very famous scene that takes place later on, but listen to Yitzchak's words. Blind Yitzchak. First of all, what does he say? I'm going to do this part quickly. What does he say when he feels the garments and he smells his son, who he thinks is Esav? Re'eh re'ach b'ni k're'ach sadeh. He smells like a field. Asher be'racho Adonai. A beautiful field. That's what Esau's clothes smell like, because he's the man of the field. And what are the most famous words about this conflict uttered by Yitzchak? Hakol Kol Yaakov, Vayadayim Yidei Esav. They're different. There's an identity known as Yaakov, there's an identity known as Esav, and I'm confused here. Thinking that the boy is Esav, what bracha does Yitzchak give him? So take a look in source 6. V'yitein lecha Elohim mital ha-shamayim mishmanei ha-aretz. What blessing does Yitzchak give who he thinks is Esav? It's the field. It's the field. Notice he does not give him a bracha of Eretz Canaan. He does not give him a bracha of fertility. He does not give him a bracha that invokes Avraham. It's a bracha of power and related to success in the field. Because that's what Esav is. What bracha does Yitzchak give Yaakov when he knows it's Yaakov? Not on the page. So much room. The El Shaddai Yivarech Otcha V'Yafrecha V'Yarbecha V'Yitein Lecha Et Birkat Avraham. Lecha U'Lezarecha Itach L'Rishtecha Et Eretz Megurecha. What is the bracha that Yitzchak gives to Yaakov, knowing it's Yaakov? Before he goes, the bracha of Avraham, fertility, you'll come back, married with children, and you will inherit this land. Because that's what the bracha of Avraham is. He never gives that to Esav. But he does say something powerful to Esav, and working on the assumption that almost all the Rishonim assume, that Rivka never told Yitzchak about the prophecy, the core prophecy of this whole story, Yitzchak nonetheless prophetically says it. What does he say to Esav? I have given your brother everything. V'haya kasher tarid ufrakta ulo me'al tzavarecha. If he pushes too hard, you'll be able to throw his yoke off of you. Rav Yavod Sa'ir will flip again. Indeed, that's going to happen in history. Okay, Yaakov runs away. He runs away because Esav wants to kill him. Esav wants to kill him because he stole the bracha. And it's a very odd thing. Yaakov is in the power seat. Yaakov is the Sa'ir who is over the Rav. And so what does this very powerful person do? He flees. And Esav's still at home seething. Years later, Yaakov comes back. When was Yaakov supposed to return? Who sent him? Who sent Yaakov? His mom. What does mom say? You go for a little while, and when Esav calms down, I'll call you. No message. 20, perhaps even longer, years pass. Yaakov doesn't hear from Rivka. One of two possibilities. Possibility one is Rivka has passed away. Possibility two is Esav's still mad. But for different reasons that belong to a different shiur, Yaakov has to leave and come back. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, time to go back. So he comes back. But he is scared, and he's especially scared when he sends messengers to Esav and finds out that Esav is coming with an army of 400 men. And in one of the most mysterious scenes in all of Tanakh, perhaps the most mysterious scene in Bereishit, itself filled with mysteries, Yaakov in the middle of the night has a famous wrestling match. And the wrestling match clearly is associated with his upcoming meeting with Esav. Is it Sarosh al Esav? Is it like the Rashbam says, a malach that was put there to force him to face Esav and not run away? But somehow it has to do with his meeting. And he's forced into having this meeting with Esav. And surprise, 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 what happens? The circles seem to close. Esav comes running up to Yaakov after seeing this huge gift that was sent and all of his family. What does he do? He embraces him. And the simple pshat is that Esav, as long ago, moved on. Simple pshat. Or at least by this point has moved on. And he embraces Yaakov. And then we go back to the Nevuah, and what do we see? Shnei goyim bevitnech, fine, or two nations. You cannot erase the past, that happened. But the second half of the pasuk, the part we really don't like, seems to be gone. They're not struggling with each other, they're embracing each other. And nobody's subjugating anybody else, they've all got plenty of wealth. You keep what you've got, I've got a lot, you've got a lot, we're all doing great. And at that point, Esav actually tries to close the circle further. Esav does. And what does Esav say? Come. Come, we'll live together. Nisa v'nelecha. What does Yaakov do? Yaakov says, I'll catch up with you. Famously, I'll catch up with you when? So we'll see next week the Pasuk in Ovadia. I'll catch up with you when Mashiach comes and Alu Moshe Maratzion Mishpot Tarisav. I'll catch up with you. Go ahead, I've got pregnant animals here. And if I move, it's dangerous. I have to go slower. You've got 400 strong men. You go ahead, I'll catch up with you. This is part of the problem of studying Yaakov. In Yaakov and issues of deception, etc. But in the interaction with Esav, things seem to be okay. At that point, we could perhaps comfortably say, okay, the nevuah was intended for just those boys. And they struggled with each other, and the relationship went up and down, and then we're done with it. And in the back of our mind, there was a voice that says, La'omi la'omi amatz is not finished. Rav Yavod Sa'ir is not close to being finished. This book has not been finished. This is only chapter one. And that's what we'll continue with. But I'd like to look backwards now and conclude by asking the question and hopefully answering it, why is this the fate of Yitzchak's kids? So please look at source one. In source one, which is where everything starts, like I said, our national story begins with this pasuk. Vayomer Adonai el Avram, lech lecha mi'artzecha mi'lomotecha beitavicha el ha'aretz asher arecha. And what does he then say? Vescha? Legoy gadol. What's goy gadol mean? A great nation. Single. A single great nation. That's what you're supposed to become, Abraham. And what is that single great nation going to do? Agad lashmecha. Heye bracha. You'll be a blessing. And the ultimate point of it is, v'nivrchu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama. Through you, the whole family of earth will be blessed. You are the fix to what's wrong with the world. And you, yourself, the nation that's going to become from you, is going to fix the world. Very nice. Will there be other nations in the world? There certainly will. Matter of fact, the other big mysterious moment in Bereishit is source 2. When Hashem comes to Avram, Brit Ben Matarim, and says to him, your kids are going to be enslaved in a land that's not theirs. They'll be oppressed for a long time. What does he say? V'gam et ha'goy asher yavodu dan anochi. The nation that oppresses them, I'll judge. Which means there will be other nations. And there'll be conflict, but that's outside of the family. That's somebody else. There are other nations in the world. And this nation of yours that you are developing is going to struggle. And through the struggles will become even greater. Okay. Achrechen yitzu v'chush gadol. But you're still one nation. Please take a look at source 3. What happens at the end of Parshat Lech Lecha? This all takes place in Lech Lecha. The beginning of Lech Lecha is Chag L'Goy Gadol. What happens by the end of Lech Lecha? Hashem comes to Avram and says, time for a name change. You're no longer Avram, you're now Avraham. And we think, wow, that's great. I can start pronouncing his name right. Why are you called Avraham? What does the Pasuk say? Ki Av Hamon Goyim Netaticha. Say, oh, that's cool. Up until now, Avram was only the father of one nation. Now he's going to be the father of many nations. No, that's not cool. That's really rotten. That's really bad. That's upsetting. That's sad. Because what does it mean? Your children will not be unified. You're going to have children who are at each other. Why? What changed between the beginning of Lech Lecha and the end of Lech Lecha? And you might think at this point, well, guess what? There is another kid in the family right now. His name is Yishmael. You can say, fine. Hamon Goyim, Yitzchak and Yishmael. Yishmael is one nation, and Yitzchak is another. By the way, there's nothing negative about these Goyim. They're not fighting with each other. They're just multiple Goyim. Okay. But the clincher comes in later on when Sarah is blessed. V'emol himel Avram, Sarai ishtecha, lo tikrat shma Sarai ki Sarah shma. We're changing Sarai's name too. Changing your name, changing Sarai's name. Uverachti ota, v'gam natati men alecha ben. I'm going to bless her and she'll also become the mother of a child. You can laugh now. Get the right name. Uverachtiha v'haita legoyim. I will bless her and she will become nations. Wait, you're going to have one son and she's going to have nations. How does a woman have one son and she's the mother of nations? That's just very simple. That son gives birth to nations. And now we see where Rivka's Nevuah comes from. Rivka's Nevuah is a continuation of the divine promise given to Avram and Sarai. Avram and Sarah. She will have one son and he will be nations. Okay. And we got to ask the question, why? What changed between the beginning of Lech Lecha to the end of Lech Lecha? The end of Lech Lecha, there's more power. There's a bigger name. And yet there's now nations divided. In the middle of Lech Lecha, there's a small parsha that's almost always kind of ignored because there's so many big things in Lech Lecha. There's Brit Ben Avatarim, and there's Brit Milah, and there's the war with the kings, and there's Paro, and all this stuff. There's a small little parsha in there, 16 psukim. It's in the middle of a huge aliyah. It's almost always ignored. Sarai, at the time, does not have any children. She and Avram have been in the land for 10 years. She turns to Avram and says, it ain't working. Here, take whom? Hagar. Take Hagar. Have a child with Hagar. Maybe that's how I'll be built up. Ulai ibaneh mimena. Play on the word ben. What does Avram do? Sarah, you want? Fakasha. Avram's loyalty to Sarah is the stuff legends are made of. Sarah says, take Hagar. He takes Hagar. Says, maybe we'll have a kid. He gets her pregnant. What does Hagar do? What does Hagar do? How does Hagar react to being this youngish slave girl from Egypt who's now carrying the seed of the head of the family, while the old lady is walking around still childless? What does Hagar do? She struts. Right? She's kind of lost her sense of being a slave. How does Sarah react to that? Sarah reacts with great anger at whom? At Avraham. She comes to Avraham. It's not on the page. I had to leave something out. She comes to Avraham and says, Chamasi alecha. I'm angry at you. Anochi natati shifchati b'chekecha. I gave you my shifcha to lie with you. Vatera ki arata, when she saw she was pregnant, va'ikal be'eneha. She's treating me lightly. Yishpot Adonai b'ini uvenecha. God will judge between us. She's taking Avraham to court. What does Avram do? Here, take her back. She was a shifcha. She was a wife. She's a shifcha again. What does Sarai do? Vate'aneha Sarai. How does Sarai treat Hagar? She presses her. Clean the toilets. No, clean it again. She makes Hagar, who Nebuch is only in this situation because Sarah demanded it. She makes her oppressed. What does Hagar do? Look how desperate this girl is. The family is in Beersheba. What does Hagar do when Sarai oppresses her? She runs away into the desert. A young, pregnant girl with nobody with her. She's a slave girl. Runs into the desert. And a malach sees her. And his first question is, Hagar Shivchat Sarai, Me'ayin Tavoyu, Anat Telchi, where are you coming from? Where are you going? Which is basically saying, are you nuts? In the desert, what do you think you're going to find here? And the Malach tells us to go back and accept Sarai as her slave girl, and she'll have a kid, and Yishmael, and he shows her the well. Be'er l'chayroi. I would never in a thousand years be able to say this. Luckily, I don't have to because the Ramban said it. The Ramban's comment here, and the Radak says the same thing, is that Sarai's behavior was unacceptable. Chat'a imenu. She sinned by treating Hagar this way. And Avraham as well, for allowing her to do it. The Ramban says something that is just so painful to say. It's a Ramban. And the punishment was that Hagar was given a son whose children would oppress Avram and Sarah's children. Ishmael. Ishmael's descendants in the time of the Ramban are making life quite difficult for the small Jewish community in Israel. Not as difficult as the Crusaders, but, you know, everybody goes up and down. They take their turns beating us up. Wow, what a statement. So I have to tell you a very sweet thing. Over Shabbat, I shared the core of this idea with my family and my daughter, Ariella, who's a senior in high school. I didn't think a senior citizen. Senior in high school. Made the following observation. She said, look at the relationship between Hagar and Sarai. Sarai is the boss and Hagar is the slave girl. What happens when Hagar gets pregnant? It gets switched. What happens after Sarai? It gets switched again. Maybe we have a little foreshadowing for Yaakov and Esav here. Yav Yavod Seir. And so what's the nevuah given? What is the promise given to Avram? You're going to be Avham on Goyim. That's nice. Sarai is going to be Legoyim, meaning she'll have one kid and that kid will have divided nations. And how is that divided nation going to play out? There's going to be a struggle in which they're always going to be in contact and one will be over the other and they're going to switch positions. So I'd like to suggest that the seeds of the key prophecy, the core prophecy that informs the relationship of Yaakov and Esav, start with Avram and Sarai, and the events that take place in their house. So I shared this observation yesterday morning with a longtime Chavrusa, Dina's brother. He said, there's something I don't like about this. Why is it that the Avot are always getting clipped in huge ways for tiny little things? My response to him was, first of all, because that's what leadership is. Avram is not just a guy. Sarah is not just a lady. These are the people who are teaching the entire world about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And yes, everything's under the microscope. And second of all, this is not something small. Oppressing a person, driving them to run away into the desert is not a small thing. And the way that some of the Rishonim, as I mentioned, Ramban, Radak, take it, is that this was an action that had repercussions through the generations. And I think that the thread of that picks up in this nevuah to Rivka. What we will see, Mir Tashem, next week, is how this nevuah and this relationship then play out from Sefer Bamidbar all the way to the end of Tanakh and Sefer Malachi, the end of nevuah and Sefer Malachi. And how the person of Esav and Yaakov and Edom and Yisrael continue to have this relationship throughout. In the meantime, have a wonderful week. And we should all experience, hear Besorot Tovot from Eretz Yisrael, and say Refuah Shlema for Yisrael Yehuda Ben Dinah Sarah.
Amen. Shikoah.